This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Invested. I'm Danielle Town. Happy Independence Day, 4th of July to all the Americans listening. And in honor of the holiday, we are going to play an episode from The Vault, which is about a question that I certainly have had many times, and I know lots of us have. Do we really need an event to invest as this market goes up and up and up? Enjoy.
Hey, everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
And welcome to the Invested Podcast, where we are talking about, well, how to get invested, right, in your life. Like, okay, yeah. That's not really what we're talking about.
It's
well,
not.
It is really what we're talking about, but only
that's
the
what
subtext.
I'm interested in.
The surface stuff we're talking about.
What's the bolded text?
The bolded text is following the investing strategies of Warren Buffett, Ben Graham, Charlie Munger, people we call rulers because they said there's only two rules of investing. Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one, which means we're teaching an investing strategy that says focus on not losing money when you put your money into something. And the way to do that is to know what you're putting your money into and what that thing is worth. And that really is what it boils down to.
Yeah. And we've both been, we've both been out, let's put it that way, for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Wow. So thanks for bearing with us. And we're very happy to be back. I'm very happy to be back. I can't see you all that well, to be honest, but even blurry, you look beautiful, Dad.
Oh, honey, that's so nice of you to say that. And I am so glad to be back from some really hardcore back surgery. They just fused two vertebrae in my spine and put in some hardware to make sure it stays there. And the surgeon who did this, a big shout out to Dr. Stephen Ray at Piedmont in Atlanta, is phenomenal. I mean, I was in so much pain for so long, like three years. And which culminated in, you know, I sort of bore up under it until something changed and I couldn't even stand up. And this incredible surgeon and his team got me in there and fixed it. And I am like new. I have no pain. It's so awesome.
Because
back surgery is scary and it doesn't always come out as well as you hope.
Super scary. Yeah.
Yeah. So huge thanks to Piedmont and especially to Waters Pavilion, where I stayed for 3 nights.
I know you told everybody about it already.
Oh, I did? Well, I must have been on drugs.
You weren't. Okay. Lest we discuss our medical ailments for too long yet again, we are getting back to business here, guys, with our investing practice, with our focus on Buffett and Munger, with our questions from you guys. We've been getting great questions, and we're just excited to roll into the new year, going strong, feeling healthy. We were just discussing right before we started recording how your health, if it's not good, it just takes out the energy for anything else until you start feeling good again.
And money, I think, is just like that. I swear it really is. It's like, if you don't have your health, that consumes you, right? But health is not the reason you're put on the planet.
Right.
You're not on the planet to just be healthy. You're here for your dharma. You're here for what you want to do, here for your passions. Money is the same way. And basically, if you don't have any, you get consumed by trying to get it. And that is so, I know it's so difficult. It just, when you're just focused on the money, whereas if you have money, you could focus on what you're here to do in your life, which is the whole idea.
Yeah. And in the same way, you're not here to have money. Money is a means to an end. It's a way to purchase things and experiences that make you feel good and support you and your family. So,
and you know, we follow Buffett and you look at, this guy is just really a master. He's a great sort of Jedi master about so many parts of life. And I think that one of the aspects that's most undersold with Buffett, because he's so successful as an investor and he's one of the wealthiest guys in the world starting from nothing, is the fact that he's an incredibly, you know, he has incredible integrity and really understands life as being very important apart from money. And he doesn't really spend a lot. Mm-hmm. He lives in a nice home, but it's just a middle-class home. I mean, anybody can drive by the fence and look in, you know? And unfortunately for him, thousands do. But he doesn't have extravagant tastes. He's not trying to impress anybody. He says, you know, people tell me I should wear nicer suits. He says, I buy expensive suits. They just look cheap on me. So he's just an example for us of someone for whom money is just a way of keeping score, you know, more than anything, about how well he's doing his job. So I think it's really important that you realize this podcast is actually about a lot more than money. And the reason I say that is we haven't talked about that a lot.
No, that's true. We haven't. And I would like us to, because we both feel very strongly about that.
I'm really impressed with an investor named Lee Liu, who we've spoken about, I think, a number of times here, who was at Tiananmen Square, went to Columbia, saw Buffett, and became a fund manager and in the 1990s and is now has a track record, I think, of over 30% per year compounded. Charlie Munger has money with Lee Liu. Mm-hmm. And he said something not too long ago at Columbia that I got a copy of that was fantastic, which is that investing is about you. It's about what you love, what are your passions, what are you good at. Mm-hmm. And he said, all you do when you're investing is you magnify that.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree with
right
that.
Right on. That is so right on. So,
and I think it's where people don't do that, that they get into trouble and they start trying to be somebody they're not. And they start trying to think that they understand something that they don't actually understand.
And don't really like and don't really want to get into it.
Or it makes you feel like a big shot and you kind of want to feel like a big shot. Or it makes you feel like, oh, I'm like really sophisticated. I can understand something that's really difficult. And that makes you feel good, you know? So there's reasons.
And I think that actually leads us to a question that I would love to cover.
Okay. So guys, remember how many moons ago, if you look back on your podcast episodes, there's one called Quick Questions, and we did it once, and then we haven't done it since then, but we have not forgotten about the excellent questions that you guys have left as little audio voice files. And if you want to go ahead and leave a question, you can do that at investedpodcast.com. There's a little thing on the side of the webpage that pops up, and you can leave your audio question. So we're going to play one today from Santiago. Here we go.
Hi, Daniel and Phil. I wanted to say thank you for all the information and insights you share in this podcast. They have been really, really useful for me as a beginner in my investing practice. I had a question. Is an event really necessary? Is it mandatory? In my investing research, I've seen great companies, by analysis, in the margin of safety price. But an event hasn't happened. And to say the truth, the company has never reached its sticker price value yet. I'd love to hear what you think. Thanks.
Okay, so to summarize.
Thank you, Santiago, first of all.
Yes, thank you, Santiago. Well, really a good question, and it... to summarize, he's basically saying, look, I've got a company that I've seen that I'm pricing. I found the sticker price of it. And let's say it's $50 a share sticker price. Mm-hmm. But the company is selling for $35 a share. And it hasn't ever been at its sticker price. And it hasn't dropped at all in any recent time. So there's no event going on.
So it hasn't been to its margin of safety price.
No, it hasn't been to its sticker.
Okay.
Hasn't been to its value. So the company has never gotten up to its value that he's calculated. It's it appears to maybe be on sale, but there's let's say it's a $50 company and it's selling for $25. It appears to be on sale, but there's no event. There's nothing in the paper. The stock price hasn't gone down. It's actually at its highest it's ever been. at $25, and it's screamingly on sale. And what he's asking is this, do I have to have an event, or can I just find companies that are actually on sale that don't have an event and just buy them, even if they haven't been to the peak?
I interpreted it very differently. Maybe I just missed his question, but the question I have, and I know a lot of people have all the time, is what do you do when a company just doesn't ever seem to get down to its margin of safety price? Maybe it's hovering around its sticker price, but nothing is happening that's making it go down. But his question is different. You're right. It is
at its margin of safety. It's just never been to the sticker, and then there's no event.
This is my first day back after surgery. I'm a little slow.
But your question
is literally
kind of the other side of the
my
coin.
First piece of work that I'm doing that I'm back. So give me a break. So he's saying, are there times when there are companies on sale without an event that have a low price that you can't explain?
Right. There you go. That's a nice way to put it. And the answer is, I would imagine on hindsight, we could find really good examples of that. Particularly in the tech industry or in pharmaceuticals or something where you would look at the company as a, you know, I'm going to assume he really understands this business really well. And he looks at it and says,
but I think that's the next thing is maybe that is a sign that there's a gap in the understanding,
which is kind of, yeah, here's the thing.
There's kind of two options here, right? You either don't totally get it, or you get it and then what? So let's assume that he totally gets it and then what?
Okay, let's assume he totally gets it and he prices it or does a margin of safety analysis, does a payback time analysis, does the 10 cap, and it's on sale. And in this is a really hard example, I think, is that it's never been anywhere near its sticker price. It's not up there. It hasn't ever been up there.
It hasn't been high is what you're saying.
Hasn't been high, and it's at its highest price historically ever. And I do see these happen from time to time. Oracle is like that not very long ago, where it appeared to be, by all criteria and margin of safety analysis, it appeared to be on sale, and yet it was at its peak price ever historically.
Hmm.
And
Fiat
you have to
Chrysler
ask yourself,
has been another one that we've talked about that's been like that.
Yep.
And other car companies.
So here's the answer, guys, that unless you truly think you're smarter than all of these people who have gone through Goldman Sachs training. They're all Harvard graduates. They're all Columbia grads, MIT. Unless you really think you're smarter than they are, it would be a very dangerous assumption that you are able to figure out the value of this business better than they can and you can buy it on sale when they think it's fully priced. That would be extremely arrogant and extremely dangerous. So I'm really pushing back on that.
I find that to be a very odd comment.
Well, think about it. In this particular example, right, the stock is at historically high prices.
Yeah.
It's Oracle a couple years ago. Historically high, and I think it's on sale. The tools say it's on sale.
Mm-hmm.
Then either my tools are geniuses who are much smarter than anybody on Wall Street who are going to push the price up if the price is low. I mean, Mr. Market is going to price this thing where it should be. The only things that keep that from happening are basically an underappreciation of what's going on in that business, or there's been an event. And when a stock is already at its historical high, then we can't say there's no event, right? There's no event. So the only other possibility for Wall Street to be wrong is that all these super smart people are simply underappreciating what's going on. And you, the ruler investor, you're not underappreciating it. You got it. You know this company's going to grow at this rate. It's going to end up with a PE right there. Your crystal ball is way better than theirs. And guys, I'm not counting on you being that smart. And I don't think you should count on yourself being that smart either. Particularly if you're just getting going on this.
So the inference is that a stock price, not a company's value, but a stock price will, by what you're saying, I can infer that it will slide around up and down with the true price where it should be generally getting hit fairly regularly. Is that what I hear you saying?
I'm not going that far as to say that. I'm saying that a company that is at its historically high price isn't, you know, it may have been flopping around to get there, but right now it's at historically high. It isn't, has never been higher than this, and there's no event. How can we assume it's on sale? That's what I'm saying.
Oh, so it's the historical high that is really getting you, I think.
Yeah. I mean, if the thing 3 years ago was at 100 and now it's at 25, I got a whole nother opinion for you here. But that's not what we're saying. We're saying in this instance, as with Oracle a couple years ago, you can look it up on a chart. It, when it was at $45 a share, it was, I mean, the market was holding it at 45 a share. It wasn't going up, but it was at its historical high.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what that means is that although the numbers look really good, when it's at historical high and you think it's on sale, you think it's on sale because the numbers look good. You're projecting a good growth rate and a good PE ratio, good free cash flow. If the market isn't taking this thing up to a reasonable value in this market, which, I mean, man, they're pricing everything higher than I want to pay. If they're not doing that on a company, it's because they know stuff you don't know about where the future could be. That means, for example, with Oracle, they know the longtime founder CEO is about to quit, for example.
It's generally called a value trap, right? It looks cheap, but actually there's something
going on. But there's stuff out there going on. Or let's say Oracle, for example. Huge questions, as with IBM, right? Can they shift to the cloud and be successful? Can they compete against Amazon's whole cloud-based business, AWS? And now here comes Microsoft out of nowhere, and boom, they have a big cloud business and they're kicking everybody's butt. And now at the same time, the founder, the energy behind the company is taking a hike. Oh yeah. And then the number two guy gets a heart attack. And then, you know, you got this stuff that's piling up uncertainty, and the market's taking a big pause and taking a big look at it. So unless you have a crystal ball that's a lot better than, you know, 1,000 analysts who are looking at that company, take a breath, step back, and go find something that fits the rules. That's my view. Don't make the mistake. So when we teach this, because we do teach about this in class, in our 3-day workshop, we basically say to everybody on day one, when they're out there trying to find a company that's something they understand, if you think it's on sale, and I think this is why the question's coming in, this guy probably took our class. If you think it's on sale and there's no event, just assume it's not on sale. Just back off. You don't have a company that's on sale if there's no event. And that's really to the heart of the question. Hmm. And the reason for that...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I see you rolling, wondering, looking...
Yeah, well, I'm thinking a lot about this view that... I mean, it's a bit odd, you have to admit, after so much focus on how the market is often wrong, to say like, well, if the market hasn't figured it out, then you're probably not smart enough to do it. I just sort of fundamentally have a problem with that, because I actually do think I'm smart enough to evaluate a company. And if I didn't, then I shouldn't really be doing this, right? So to say that it must be underappreciated, or we have to assume that it's underappreciated by the market in order to move forward... yeah, I think we do. And wouldn't there's many opposite examples, right, of companies that this is all based on forward growth rates. So based on forward growth rates of what you think is going to happen with a company, it could look decently priced to you, and yet the market isn't appreciating it because of short-term considerations. I think of Amazon back in like 2010, 2011, when that stock price had no business being what it was, because they weren't really making that much money. But people there, I've seen some presentations from investors from back then who saw the potential of it, and you know, obviously did amazing. So,
but look at honey, the whole game that we're playing is that we're not super smart. I don't want to get into a game where I've got to be smarter than people that I'm not smarter than. And those guys are smarter than me.
Why is that even an issue? Who cares who's it's smarter than issue. Who?
All those graduates from Harvard and Columbia and MIT are super smart people, and their careers are on the line to do exactly this kind of thing. Figure out whether Amazon is a good deal. And the fact that some of them figured it out doesn't mean anything about our ability to figure it out when it's hard, which is why I don't want you to go off and start violating basic rule one strategy, which is we don't jump over 6-foot bars. We don't do that. Don't try to do that. It's a huge mistake to think that you can leap over a 6-foot bar.
No,
our job is to jump over 6-inch bars.
And yet our job is also to think about what's going to happen with a company in the future. And the only way to do that is to take some guesses and invent things and see what they plan to do and debate if you think that they're actually going to do that thing and decide if you can really trust in the growth rate that you're picking, right?
Well, I don't love the idea of taking some guesses, but I guess we always have a little bit of uncertainty about where this thing's going to go.
Of course.
What my point is that you can do that on companies where it's pretty obvious, or you can do it on companies where it's really hard. Your example of Amazon was too hard for Buffett.
Oh, so what you're
and
saying...
And you're thinking, oh yeah, I can do this. No, you should not be thinking that you can do this. Because because here's the thing. We're not investing the way most of these other people invest. They're buying maybe 1% of their portfolio into a company, okay? So what we're doing is we're going in 10%. We're taking a big bite of the apple, whatever it is we're going to do.
Well, not so with we this have kind have of company where you're not really sure, right? This would be in the risky business section where it is like 1%.
Okay, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the main
portfolio. So we're talking about main portfolio, companies at its historical high. I can't figure out a single thing wrong with it. It seems awesome, which explains why it's at its historical high. But mm-hmm. my numbers are leading me to think that it should be even higher.
Should be twice as high.
Should be twice as high.
Mm-hmm.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I mean,
okay, so I'm going to give you an example of a company I bought that was exactly that situation.
Okay, all right? Do.
Because I do occasionally, and it did go into the risky biz portfolio, but that's Google. So it came public at, I don't know, just under $100 or something back in the day. And I didn't really understand it, so I didn't buy it at the IPO, even mm-hmm. though it had several years of track record. It was cash flow positive. I bought it at 200. So I bought it after it had already doubled once. So it was at its historical high and I still bought it. So this is the exception that proves the rule in my view, is that this was to me a pretty easy call because I use their product a lot and I came to understand it. And I think understanding it was not something a lot of people had done yet. They didn't understand how its business model worked. And it was so new that it didn't fit the criteria for a lot of what fund managers put money in. So there's the exception, all right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay with that exception. I could figure out Google, and I still love it. It's still an amazing company. I couldn't figure out Amazon, and neither could Buffett and Munger too hard, even though some Wall Street people did, all right?
Oh.
I couldn't figure out Facebook.
I mean, they
Facebook.
Said that they screwed up on that one.
Yeah, they screwed up on it.
Yeah.
You're going to have to let some stuff go. You're going to realize that we screw up a lot more than we want to say, but our screw-ups are errors of omission. We don't do something we could have maybe done. Those are screw-ups I can handle. I don't mind not making money on something I wasn't sure about, even though it goes up. And I'm telling you, I have to deal with that all the time. My analysts will pick something and they'll look at it and they'll go, this is going to blast off. If I don't get it, I don't buy it. And then it doubles, right? And I'm just like, mm-hmm. Well, that's the way she goes when you're following this strategy of 6-inch bars. You're going to have companies you didn't buy into that took off.
Yeah, we spent a bunch of time talking about that.
Yeah.
I'm still so do you
are you grasping, are you agreeing with me here that as basic strategy, if that thing hasn't had an event that creates fear in all of those analysts as they jockey quarter to quarter for who's the best, with an event that's going to last a year to 3 years, that's going to kick almost all the fund managers out of that business because they don't want to be in it for a year of it losing money, they are going to go. And when they do, then we've got something that's more of a 6-inch bar. Not all of them are 6-inch bars, but enough of them are that we can make an incredible rate of return by being patient and not trying to be better than Mr. Market at picking high prices and saying that they're on sale.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I just also think that there are a lot of companies that have been underpriced at points at which they maybe didn't look underpriced. And I find those intriguing.
Well, yeah, just don't intrigue them into your portfolio. I mean, this is to our whole population of investors who have a huge range of skills and a huge range of different kinds of passions and things they're interested in, that the basics of our style of investing are so fundamental. And if you stick with them, you are going to get rich. There's no way you won't. It's stepping out of the boundaries of our skill set that's what gets you losses and the violation of rule number one, where you think you know the thing is at high price, but you think you know it's on sale. All right. So if you're going to do that sort of thing, you're going to jump in and buy something you think is on sale, even though the market is screaming that they don't think it's on sale, just at least take a step back and be humble for a moment and say, wow, maybe there's something going on here I don't understand. Mm-hmm. Maybe they know stuff I don't know because they've got contacts in New York and they've got friends everywhere and they talk to venture capital guys and whatever, right? They totally are networked in ways we aren't.
Yeah, and which, I'm by the way, is a very different thing from being smart. It's just different information. It's an information asymmetry.
Okay. Point being?
The point is that this whole thing about like how, oh, they're smarter than us is like so contrary to the whole thing of they're dumber than us and therefore they misprice stocks all the time. And just this whole sort of dichotomy constantly of like who's smarter and who's dumber, I just feel like is kind of silly. And it's really about the amount of information that people have. I think you and I and a lot of people listening to this podcast are very smart. And if we put our minds to it, we can do this. That's what I've learned. And this idea that like these mysterious faceless people are like dumber or smarter, I just don't find that useful. But maybe it's useful to other people.
Well, I think it's very useful. I mean, I think you should really listen to your daddy.
Oh, really?
And be a little humble.
So depending on the situation.
I know you went to all the same schools. You're not intimidated by all these Ivy League people because you went to those schools.
No, that's not my point. My point is that you started out my education telling me that those people were dumb. And we spent like a year debating whether or not they were dumb. And I was arguing for their intelligence. And now you're telling me they're really smart. I'm not trying to argue for their dumbness, but I'm trying to say we are just as smart.
Well, I'm pretty sure I have never said that those Harvard graduates are dumb.
Oh, I'm pretty sure I could roll some tape.
I'm pretty sure I said that. In the context of fear, they do dumb things. Okay, and that's very different.
No, so, I distinctly remember you saying, these people must be stupid. Why else would they do what they do?
If I said it, it's hyperbole. because I know they're smart people. It's just that fear makes people do dumb things. It really does.
That's right.
I mean, when you don't have to be doing something, you do it anyway.
Well, or as we spent a bunch of time talking about, it's not dumbness or smartness or fear even, or bravery or whatever. It's different incentives than what we have. And I think actually here again, I would make the same point. So in this situation, what you're saying is that people who are professional in the finance world tend to have maybe more sort of scuttlebutt talk on the street type of, now you've got me using the word scuttlebutt talk on the street type of information of like, oh, so-and-so is going to quit, you know, or like, won't be at the company next year for whatever, like, ooh, gossipy reason. And we who are, you know, sitting in our houses on Main Street don't have that information, which is totally correct. And again, it's just different. It's an asymmetry. It's instead of being incentives, it's information. And I think that that's really important to acknowledge. And actually, I'm really glad we're making this point that there is different information from what I have, you know, sitting in my house looking at the internet and reading newspapers compared to somebody on Wall Street. It is different. And sometimes that information makes them act, in your words, dumb, because they go and they make decisions based on some week, you know, weekly thing or monthly thing or quarterly thing. And sometimes it makes them take decisions that are, in your words, smart, because it makes them not buy into a stock where the CEO is about to quit. And just being aware that that information is different, I think, is actually really important. I'm really glad we're talking about it. I'm having aha moment right now.
Okay, so you can aha this.
Okay.
That Ben Graham, so many years ago, 90 years ago, made an incredible, sort of had incredible insight. And that insight said that in the long run, the stock market is a weighing machine. Mm-hmm. It is going to properly value each company. Mm-hmm. But in the short run, it's a voting machine. And by that, he meant it's about momentum and emotion, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. In the short run. Mm-hmm. And so we know that because of momentum and emotion, momentum can be momentum down, it can be momentum up, and emotion is fear and greed. The short run pricing on stocks can be badly off of their value. So we know this is the general thesis that we follow as ruler investors, that stocks can be badly off of their actual value for some relatively short period of time. And over the relatively long period of time, they're going to be properly balanced. They're mm-hmm. properly priced. Mm-hmm.
Okay? Which is why I think you emphasize so much the historical high part of that piece of information.
Exactly right. Because if the company has historically not gone above this price point ever, and there's no visible event, then where's the emotion coming from? There's no momentum carrying it forward at this point because it's peaked out. It's all been momentum to this point. Where's the emotion? Where's the fear? Mm. Where's the greed? Mm. Mm. And it's drained out of the market. And when it's drained out of the market, you're going to be looking at a company that Mr. Market is looking at pretty objectively, and it may be priced properly. He may be weighing that company actually pretty properly for what's going on there. So
I think we should
wrap this. Yeah. We beat this around a bit, but I would love you to think more seriously, take it more seriously, that if you really don't identify the fear and the event that's driving the fear, be very, very careful before you pull the trigger on a company where it doesn't have that.
I've just written down for myself, which I think might make it onto my checklist. Where is the emotion? Where's the fear? Where's the greed?
Good.
Because I'm not sure I've actually pinpointed like that angle to it. It's like, oh, what's the event? What's happening with it? Why do, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But not like, where is it? Like if you're looking at a company that's just been on a really lovely, steady upswing, where is the emotion? It's like, you're right. There isn't, there's no fear. There's no greed. It's just sort of, everything's all right.
There it is. Yeah. Everything's good.
Except that maybe it's not because they're not pricing it higher.
Well, we got another question.
Yes, but we're going to do that next time. Another quick questions.
Yeah. Dad. I keep thinking we're going to knock off five or six of these in one shot, but we don't. So the next one I think is really cool. And it's a really good question.
It is.
About public companies in bankruptcy.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll be back next week with that. And thanks, everybody. Thanks for bearing with my brain fog. It'll probably be here for another few weeks, let's be honest.
Time to go play, guys. See ya.
Bye.
Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information, including show notes and more episodes, visit us at investedpodcast.com. There's a special offer waiting for podcast listeners to attend my 3-day investing workshop absolutely free. So just head to investedpodcast.com. Everything discussed on this podcast is either my opinion or Danielle's opinion and is not to be taken as investing advice, because I am not your investment advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I hope you enjoyed it.